Chariot Solutions TechCast for Friday, August 22nd, 2008. I'm your host, Ken Rimple. Welcome. On the show today, part 3 of our series on startups and technology. This time it's Tapinko, another dream adventure whose technology is based in .NET. I speak with Nicholas Warren and Jonathan Valentine, who discuss their approach for building their application on a .NET platform. Tapinko's application is a marketplace for buying and selling advertisements. You could place an ad on your car, for example, and someone could purchase it, all in an online marketplace. You can find out more about Tapinko at their website, www.tapinko.com. That's T-A-P-I-N-K-O.com. Let's listen in.
In software, you're creating something new out of nothing every day, right? Architects, what do? You sit there and you kind of architect the building, and you know you've got beams that have to deal with load-bearing walls, and you're working with very, very physical constraints. And so you know you're building these real-world things, right? But in software, there's nothing real, right? You're building software, which is ideas turned into moving software parts, right? Electrons moving around. So 10 different people would do the same project 10 totally different ways. They might have a same angle. You might say, okay, well, if I'm doing, let's say, Java in my case, and you guys are doing .NET, okay, I'll probably use maybe Struts, or I'll use Spring MVC, or I'll use some sort of web framework. Mm-hmm. But you know, I know overall my approach for designing the database might be slightly different or wildly different depending on how I approach it versus somebody else's. I might say use Postgres as a database. Right. Someone else might say, yeah, but MySQL is a better one. Technology choices.
Yeah, I feel that that's pretty accurate. Some of the that's an accurate comparison to make, something real or something that's not real but has the same elements. Some of the best analogies I've been able to make when trying to explain this to non-technically minded people, mm-hmm. is to make that analogy of building a building, because a building is comprised of the components,
right,
that they used to build it, a foundation, whether it was concrete, mm-hmm. whether it was they used I-beams, or they actually used solid walls and poured it the way, and then you've got plumbing and things like ventilation, and these things, you can make all the references to things in software, everything from creating extracts for data, or mm-hmm. creating a data layer that you're calling to, or making stored procedures to go and get your, and these kind of things all relate to the electricity that's running through the building. Do you put that up, or do you put the walls on with the windows first? And these, and what even just the delineation of what comes before the next thing, it's the perfect analogy, building a building and building some software.
Mm-hmm. Now, just a couple.
It's a good analogy for business when they don't get.
That's what I'm saying.
When there's a certain amount of planning they have to do, it instills upon them that, hey, this is obviously a lot more complicated than a construction project you'd have, let's say, if you're adding a master suite to your house, but you're ready to embark on it with a lot less planning. So the house analogy is one everybody gets their heads around, just so from a planning perspective, right, they get it. We need to do some concrete planning here. But the interesting part of that analogy is, you can put the wiring on the outside of the drywall and flip it the next day and nobody notices.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you put the other pieces together properly. So there is,
you're not gonna put the roof on top of the foundation, and you're not gonna put the windows in the electric
circuitry. Right. But you can't do mass reorganizations, but at a smaller level you can do organizations because things are virtual. But the analogy for me, the strongest point of it is you're impressing upon people that they have to do a certain amount of planning and they have to really understand what they're building. But yeah, once you get in there, you don't put the it's a mass change to your code to put the ceiling on the third floor and the roof underneath where the foundation was. But there's softer pieces inside of that you have a lot of leeway with, and that's really important when you're a startup, because when you're a startup, you have to know as much not what to care about as what to care about.
Mm-hmm. Where the strength of the structure is going to come from, and where you can cut corners and where you can't.
Well, you know, it's interesting because even then, if I would think there's a trade-off in the startup, because I've worked with some over my career, that sometimes you're building that first starter home ranch house, right? But you'll eventually want to move into the nice luxury high-rise apartment building and start charging massive rent.
Gotta start somewhere.
So sometimes you'll pick technologies, right? And you'll say, well, I'm picking a particular choice on my architecture, my scaling, or my physical hardware, what have you, that's a trade-off for now. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm going to have to redo it later, right?
Right, right.
There's always that.
We're trying, we realize we're doing that, and we're trying to do that mostly in the presentation of things,
mm-hmm.
But not in the more systemic parts of the application, like the security or
core foundational pieces.
Yeah, like one of the things we're doing is, you know, the ASP.NET 3.5 Visual Studio 2008 stuff. It's great stuff. There's a lot of good stuff in there. There's some bad stuff in there too, right, that you don't want to use.
Right.
Server controls are the most wretched thing in the world. We've thrown them away, and
right.
people are, that's really foreign concept to most people because they're like, well, that's kind of the heart of how I use ASP.NET. Well,
it's
really
pretty, right? It's pretty to put together, probably easy for the use in the IDE,
but... It's
pretty
fast put together, and then, you know...
Performance?
The performance, yeah, the performance is bad with the AJAX control toolkit.
Mm-hmm.
The runtime does reflection over every page to see what you've included and re-emits the script for those controls again.
Right.
So one of the things we're using is we are using a lot of different open source approaches to things. So we're using the jQuery library and
mm-hmm.
a whole bunch of jQuery plugins to do all of our UIs as AJAX from mm-hmm. the very beginning. And that's completely agnostic to ASP.NET. So
right.
in fact, every single example that we found out there that we used to formulate our code base and get it moving in part of our framework was PHP. But we're completely agnostic on the UI side, and we could flip to PHP MySQL with a lot less pain than any other .NET project that you probably know of. Not
mm-hmm.
that we're going to do that, but that's kind of one of the benefits we got of this particular kind of approach, is we're not relying on not only the completely horrid semantics of what these server controls look like once you put them in place and you make them work right,
right.
but all the performance crap that goes along with them and the fact that now your UI is married to the Microsoft technology.
Right, right.
We've gotten away from all that stuff.
So I guess you're different in that a lot of companies wouldn't choose something like a .NET or a Java. You know, I'm throwing Java, Enterprise Java kind of in the same loop,
mm-hmm.
right? You can build a nice foundation that's core. Architecture is very easy to maintain and very easy to extend. Easier in a tool like a language like a .NET or language like a Java. I shouldn't say language like .NET, but in a platform like .NET,
mm-hmm.
Where you have libraries and depend on other libraries and a nice, rich, object-oriented, you know, language system.
Right.
But a lot of other startup groups here are doing things like PHP, or they
mm-hmm.
might be using Python, for example, which is, you know, certainly has its object-oriented features, but it's more of a scripting language that grew up, right? Someone's going to kill me for that, I think. But so talk to me about your selection of .NET. Is it primarily because when the two of you came together, or the three of you, I guess, came together for this, one of you had .NET as a very strong background?
When we were originally playing this almost 2 years ago, I was just finishing up working at a custom software house and was getting much more familiar with the enterprise-level softwares that are out there,
mm-hmm.
the ones that really had a future to them, that had serious legs. And one of the things that I recognize about a startup is you need to have resources available to you. So one of the prominent things to go with was .NET because of how available the resources were.
That's a huge thing. Yeah,
it's a huge thing, and it seems like a fairly practical way or even simplistic way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you need the resources and you need qualified people, you've got a language that's fully supported, that has future versions already in planning coming out, lots of qualified people out there to choose from, as well as it being a robust language in itself that no one can really bat an eye at. You have some Java people or people who said, oh, well, I've been working at Sun for 10 years and and really it's this and that. Well, you can battle right back.
I have a hammer and there's this nail.
Yeah.
And this is like another nail to me, but yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of it is personal preference over
yeah.
Who you're going with, but I also find that with a language like that, you have a lot of extremely qualified people to choose from that would even be willing to come aboard with a startup because there's so many people out there. There's not really competition there amongst them, but there's people who are looking to do new things with it. It's been around a while. There's lots of help
right.
out there. There's so much, and again, we're going an open source route.
So it's a good marketplace decision. Yeah,
it's a good marketplace decision. It was somewhat of a business decision as well, though, because you have to absolutely consider your language when you're thinking about moving in the future, creating partnerships,
mm-hmm.
Either at a technological level or a business level. So there were a lot of different factors that went into going with that.
Okay, great.
I think there's some other connection points I can mention real briefly, and they directly kind of flange off or parlay on some of those concepts. One of them is, in a startup, right, you want to keep your team as small as possible. And so I've programmed on embedded targets, I've programmed on VAXs, I've programmed on Apples, I've programmed on HP mini computers, a whole lot of different development I've done. but where the largest breadth of capability that I have is in Microsoft products. Mm-hmm. Again, in terms of keeping the team small and somebody who can go end-to-end, so I can jump in and do anything they need to do with Visual Studio 2008.NET 2035 or whatever it might be. I can also set up the production infrastructure for SQL Server with web servers, load balancers, the whole entire thing. I mean, when we go live, our go-live hardware infrastructure is bare metal web servers, bare metal database with dark virtual servers sitting next to them for $5 a month. And it's just the level of access we have to the breadth that a startup needs and the amount of people that you can do it in is... you can keep things a very small team.
You're right on target. Small team, cost is down.
Yeah.
Resources are available. Strength is there and prominent and unquestioned.
Yeah. And support is there.
I don't think anybody, even on the extended development team, is in any way a technology bigot. So mm-hmm. we know what we're looking for, right? So we know Java had generics before 2005, like .NET did.
Right.
And we know what continuations and closures are in Ruby, and we know that when we read people like Wes Dyer's blog, who's part of the Link team at Microsoft, and he's showing us prototypical syntax for a closure or a continuation, which he was doing 2 years ago for generics or 3 years ago for generics. So we kind of know where the language is going, and we know where the competing languages like Ruby on Rails and things. We understand functional programming and functional languages, and we understand that our language is the least of those. Right, but it also doesn't hit mem limits every 5 minutes on the Unix kernel.
Yeah, I know about that.
So
from a Java perspective.
So you know, it's a choice that we make, but it's not a choice that we made just because we have Microsoft blinders on.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we know what's out there in the rest of the world, and this is a conscious decision that we made. And I think one of the things that it gives us, especially with Visual Studio 2008 and the Link capabilities that are built into it, is it really gives us a rad tool set advantage. We are building things very, very quickly now with our tool set, and I think that's really key in terms of feature delivery and how far we can stay out ahead of our competition, who maybe can't deliver us faster. So in the end, picking this tool set might be an actual strategic advantage in terms of how quickly we can deliver, at least with the team we have now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So being Microsoft centric and focused, that
right,
team,
right, right. Okay. So when you're doing .NET development right now, you said you kind of pared down some of the pretty widgets that do lots of functionality behind a black box, kind of the server controls you were mentioning.
Yeah, we got rid of server controls. We don't use any .NET server controls.
Mm-hmm. Are you building kind of the difficulty I had when I played around with .NET and did one project with it, so I would call myself a play-arounder with .NET,
mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, I was looking more for building an MVC framework,
mm-hmm.
Because that's what I'm used to, as opposed mm-hmm. to doing kind of the web forms framework.
Yep.
And in fact, the Java world kind of took what .NET did and went, wow, we could do our own, you know, forms-based framework, and came up with JSF,
mm-hmm.
which kind of was like an outcropping. The mm-hmm. two always compete with each other, so right. to speak, with ideas.
Right.
How did you approach the web side of it? Like, are you using an MVC framework? Are you doing...
No. So .NET now has... There's the alt.NET group, mm-hmm. and Scott Hanselman and Scott Guthrie at Microsoft are promoting the whole MVC approach to building web apps.
Okay.
We didn't really have the time to flip everybody's brains over to MVC and to flip the framework over to MVC. Now, having said that, the way that we've built our application, which is really, you know, it's what I would call a think client or a web 2.0 type of application, whereby all the data comes to the browser as JSON data. Mm-hmm. It's all bound and unbound at the client and sent back as JSON data. MVC starts to apply less in those type of paradigms.
Absolutely.
Because I'm not looking for this glued together interaction. It's more of a true distributed computing environment where the browser's not just this non-participatory static display thing anymore.
It's client-server again.
It's starting to be a true client-server distributed computing model, mm-hmm. and the benefit of that obviously comes with scale, because when I add a client, I'm really adding horsepower. And again, when I look at my back end, because I've done it this way, what's my back end do? It's processing security, selecting data, and making JSON arrays for the front end. That's
right.
Really all it does.
So it doesn't need the sophistication of that. It needs
right.
to provide services you can call into to get data back.
It's almost a pure service layer. So mm-hmm. the MVC-ishness of what you need when you get web forms and all those things, you get It's different. I'm not saying that. So one of the big things everybody likes about MVC is separation of concerns and testability, right? That's
right,
what you get coming out of that.
But you already got the service layer, so to speak. So you've already made that distinction.
And so we can address code coverage from a testability standpoint, at least from what do things look like going back and forth to this Think client layer. How we test that on the Think client layer is probably even more of a challenge than in a regular web form scenario.
How do you test an AJAX app?
Yes, exactly. That's the question. And we're figuring some of that stuff out. And we're also just ramping up, and we've got to do everything at once, right? We've got to build a product and ramp up our process. So some of the things aren't in place yet that will be. We're going to, I'm a big fan of JetBrains products. And JetBrains makes Team City, which is a cruise control NAND replacement that's drag and drop and click and free for one server. So that's a good thing, because I don't like creating NAND scripts, really. They're kind of pain in the butt. So we're working on all that. But in the end, and some of this ties back to we're building a house, and how can you walk through it? Well, you can walk through it if we have a build that automatically executes and deploys what we have each night on the server. We're moving toward that. I'm actually remiss in my duties and giving it to business so they get more tangibility. But we're not using MVC now, and we looked at it and decided, A, that we couldn't absorb it in our platform, and it didn't really apply to us. Yeah.
Right.
But in terms of testability, we've just started to add the unit test harnesses to the project, and so that when code is checked in, the unit test harnesses will run, and they'll return environment variable error codes that will make a build succeed or fail, and then prompt its automatic deployment. We're getting there. We're not there yet.
Okay.
Right now, we're building a ton of software quickly.
You're in build mode, construct mode.
We're in build mode. Our framework is behaving nicely across all the browser platforms, Safari, Opera, IE, Firefox. We've got a couple glitches that we're working out, but that's really a big struggle, is to get a framework that plays nicely and works across all those platforms and then allows you to rapid application develop, and we're there right now.
Great. So any other libraries or frameworks you're taking advantage of? So you've got, you know, basically your traditional Microsoft stack in terms of the hard the main components. You've got SQL Server and, you know, .NET framework, and now you're using jQuery on the, you know, the libraries for the front end.
Yeah, we're using jQuery as our basic AJAX library.
Right.
We're using Tommy Tomoff's JQ Grid for tabular data display. Another part of our technology stack is REST. All of our URLs are REST-style URLs. That's pretty neat, because now we can support things like www.tapinko.com/your company as your public profile. We've modified some of the JQ Grid stuff to do REST-style query requests, and Tommy Tomoff is already integrating those back into JQ Grid. Hey, that's why you use open source, right?
Excellent.
I sent him $20 in PayPal for his efforts through Liz's account. But the JQ Grid, the jQuery validators, the jQuery interface library, we have some stuff that looks real Web 2.0, almost Flash-like, with animations that we can do with jQuery. So, we're able to give a really good Web 2.0/AJAX experience, and we're using all open source control stack to do that with. But that's really it. We're not really employing any other libraries or methodologies to speak of. We're doing REST query string remapping and a complete generic data layer. Our data layer is written completely with .NET generics. And the data access and the data CRUD operations are trivial for all the developers. It's something they don't think about right now. Really, what a developer does now when they build a widget in Tapinko is strictly to focus on the UI, and they think very little about the back end, because A, the table design and such has been thought out, and the design's been thought out, but B, there's no data access code per se to write. They implement a very small interface for a link data type and a partial method that simply defines what the PK is, and one other thing for loading the graph deep or shallow, and they're done.
Okay.
So that's what they focus on when they develop. Now it's all UI. So we know we're getting to the good part, because they're actually building the tangible thing. And that's what they spend the most amount of time on. So that feels right now.
So how'd you do the development process? How many developers do you have total working on this with you?
Right now, there's three of us.
Okay.
If you don't count Nick as an engineer.
Still
coming up as an engineer.
Three plus Nick kind of getting there as the engineering, but providing kind of the business acumen and so on, correct?
Yeah.
Well,
I'm pretty much exclusively wearing the design BA hat right now. For... 18 months now or so, I've been out there actually collecting the use cases from the people who are going to be using this, the publishers and everyone, and speccing out UIs that they're going to need, not to completely replace some of the software they're using right now, but we're seeing Tapinko as a complement to a lot of the tools that they're used to using, and cherry-picking functionality,
mm-hmm.
and thinking about it in an aspect of, is it going to work? And if it's going to be web-based, we're going to need something that's going to be fast and with as few clicks as possible, packing in information. So sort of applying somewhat of a programmatic school of thought to what would basically be a research job. But now I'm designing out the pages and everything, which is mm-hmm. nice.
I should step back since we went right into the tech, and I thought it was a really good kind of introduction into the discussion here, and talk about what Tapinko does. So let's do the soapbox pitch, if we
absolutely.
Will.
Tapinko is the online marketplace for advertising space. So what we do is we provide a marketplace for buyers and sellers of traditional advertising space to work and complete their sales. It's everything that you would find offline.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's a periodical, a magazine, or a newspaper, if it's a taxi cab, or if it's in a subway station, or outdoors, or if it were an indoor wall hanging in an athletic facility of your university, if there's advertising space, you can create the dimensions of it online and sell it as if it were a product on eBay. But we're starting in the university niche to take over and nail down a beachhead from which to launch our software and eventually ramp up to what we're calling the Open Inco, which is something that can sort of create a market that is at the moment non-existent. So everywhere where you look around, from the wall behind you to your car door, one of the kind of nice things to throw out there in little elevator pitches, how much gas it's costing you to make it to the meeting today. Well, you could have subsidized that had you sold an advertisement on your car door. There's a lot of non-existent space out there that can be capitalized on.
Mm-hmm.
And from a lot of the projections from just a few people around here at DreamIt and people with whom we have our brainstorming meetings, we predict that it could be a larger market. The non-existent market could be bigger than the market that exists right now today. So
mm-hmm.
That's our eventual goal, and we're starting out and ramping up to that.
Now, you got the September 4th deadline, I suppose, looming for what DreamIt wants you to pitch to them and explain to them.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, you're planning on launching the university site shortly thereafter?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the goal?
Yeah. We should actually have something that's functional for a transaction just before funding day, if everything, knock on wood, no one croaks or anything.
Right.
And
wow. This is a startup, but what kind of startup are we talking about here?
It's not as if we're working 26-hour days.
Right.
We only work 23.
23,
days.
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. all. No, I got to say, this guy, Jonathan, he's making some serious sacrifices, and we're absolutely blessed to have him here working with us. But, I mean, aside from that, we do make little jokes around here that some of the guys in the business end, they're saying, so you're not actually turning out version 1.0, you're turning out version 0.75, aren't you? And we're like, yeah, so sort of it's going to be version 0.75. It's going to be functional. It's going to satisfy the needs of the beta set that's going to start.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much classic XP/agile software development.
Mm-hmm.
We know the use cases that we have to support: registration, find ad, buy ad, etc.
Right.
And so we're going to support that minimal set of use cases so that the software is demonstrable and there's a whole bunch of it in place. It'll be usable, if not very close to usable, on that date. Now, having said that, the feature set's going to go like this after that date,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to revisit things and refactor things and such.
Right. I think that the difference here, and I'm sure every team has their you know, edge. It sounds like the difference here is you're providing a framework that can be easily extended. That you kind of build a core foundational architecture, and you're providing yourself a development methodology that you're sticking to. And I'm sure there are startup groups that are just kind of flailing at it, but they're good technical people, so they're flailing at it and getting further along as they go. But it's sometimes it's a lot more painful if you don't go and do those. It's all the times it's more painful if you don't do the requirements gathering and the use case analysis and all the other things.
Right, or even just some background engineering work where you say, "Hey, I've got to build some framework stuff that's not really tangible to business."
Yeah,
but you know that's hard when you come aboard because you want to show demonstrable. Well,
right.
But it's a two-way street because business wants to see demonstrable progress immediately. They want to see something tangible. And if you're a good engineer, you want to keep business happy.
Yes.
And you want to please them. And so you want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But your gut...
But you also need...
But your gut tells you that you need the oxygen and the water and the other critical elements as part of the mix. And that was something...
If I don't have my service layering figured out and I don't know how to get to a database in a fast manner, for example,
right.
And I don't have my data mapping strategies figured out,
right.
Then I'm going to build you something that's a one-off and the next thing's a one-off and the next thing's a one-off. Right.
And then you get a lot of divergence in the work product.
Yeah,
right?
You can tell five developers worked on it in that case.
And right now, okay, if you look at the different components that have been built, one of our developers, his name is Jeff Klein, you look at the stuff he's built, you look at the stuff I built, I'll give you $20 if you can tell me who built it, unless he put his name in a comment.
In a comment
somewhere. Or some other very small idiosyncratic thing that he does in code that no one else notices but me because I've worked with him for such a long time,
mm-hmm.
like the fact that he'll do a comment and then no space before his comment starts and I put a space
there's always some small
very small things that I've got to just know over the years through these people. So
you know, and tying all the way back to the beginning of our conversation, we're talking about the building, the roof and the house and everything. I think the tough part about software development is the inspection concept, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get your home pro guy or whatever he is and he comes back with a book and he says, oh, you want to buy a house? Let's walk through with my ladder. I'll get up on the roof and take a look at things. And there's variance in the way you build stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But with software, it could be anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, .NET and your designs around .NET, I would assume it makes it easier to do software inspections. Are you going through periodically in this project and looking at code or is there no time for that?
In terms of code that other developers write?
Yeah, like for example, are you peer
every
reviewing?
Line of code that gets written.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there's not time for them to do the same for me.
Right.
As we get bigger, somebody will absolutely be reviewing my code.
But mm-hmm.
all the code that's checked in now by the development team, I look at it. And I look at it for a lot of different reasons. I don't just look at it to see did they do things they shouldn't have done or did they do anything novel that's kind of neat that could be shared elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I just get a feel for where were they in the software, right? What I know what you're, then it's more almost more of a task management thing than
right.
it is an engineering thing. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I look at all the code that's checked in. I ultimately bear full responsibility for all the code and its suitability and for production.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to do that. And yeah, it pains me a little bit when I'm doing that instead of adding more value to the product by adding features. But I already know what happens if I don't. I've been there before. So
absolutely, I know exactly where you're going. Yeah,
I'm sure Jonathan's felt. Just as much stress as I have recently. It is hard being sort of an intermediary between the business and the development that's going on because when you've got people to satisfy and some weeks go by and they don't see anything visual for them to touch and play with, you know, it comes down and figuring out ways to express what's actually happening is hard. And you can show them the pages of code and, of course, they balk. But But now that they're seeing things cranking out and when they say, wouldn't that be nice if there was a button here
mm-hmm.
and these things happen before their eyes, then of course they're just
right.
giggles.
It's all that foundational, you know, baking of the cake before serving it part that, you know.
And believe me, it was minimal, but
mm-hmm.
you have to have it. And
but you have a short window anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, you have an extremely short window at Dream It, right?
Yeah.
I was going to say, it's also one thing that we were not going to cut any corners on, making something that was stable. We didn't want to have to go through a rewrite or a rebuild halfway into it because we're kicking into a market that's grandiose,
mm-hmm.
to say the least. It's something that's so big, once we ramp up, it could be like a financial institution where you simply don't stop to recode something because there's too much going on, too many people using it to be able to stop.
You don't want the IBM commercial, right? That famous commercial where they said, we got our first order, okay, fifth order, 5,000th order, you're going, oh, how are we going to serve all these customers? You know,
right.
So you're looking at the end game and saying volume is going to be the key,
but
right?
We're looking at the end game as much as we can afford to.
Yeah, obviously.
And we could afford to look at it a little bit. And, you know, if you ask me, are we building this application to be super scale, I would just absolutely not. It's not super scale. There's not a team of engineers building it, and it's using Microsoft products and SQL Server. It's not super scale.
It'll get so far, yeah.
But it's enterprise scale easily,
mm-hmm.
and it can serve thousands upon thousands of concurrent concurrent users.
You can cluster it and you can do whatever you need to do. Yep. Right. Yeah, but you know what parts you would change. And that's the key thing. You know where the pain points are going to be from experience working with these kind of platforms. And so it's interesting to see the different approaches that everyone's going
And there through. there are certain patterns we could have followed that would have taken more time that to convert or refactor to will be painless. As an example right now, all of our JSON data comes right from our pages. But we can convert over to Windows Communication, WCF Foundation, and now we can completely distribute all the data access across as many nodes as we want through WCF. And incidentally, another thing that this parlays into is that the headless architecture, the, we're using .NET on the middle tier, but you know, on the outside you can't really tell, is that lends itself very much to where we would want to go in the future. If that happens to be Silverlight, we can convert to Silverlight very easily with our architecture that we have right now. Again, when we looked at it, it would have been nice to deploy a Silverlight site. It's too much to do quickly.
And it's a relatively new technology from their perspective, too.
And it's new technology, but we're positioned to take advantage of it because we're not down in an architectural blind alley at all with that end of the architecture.
Right. It's not like you're using a closed protocol. You're using JSON data, which...
Yeah, we're using JSON data.
You can take that.
Through async HTTP requests, and that's... And if we flip it over to use WCF, this is exactly what Microsoft prescribes that a Silverlight implementation would look like, is Silverlight controls using Windows Communication Foundation to get JSON data. We have all that, except we have HTML widgets getting JSON data.
You just flip out.
That's
from
the only difference, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
So
now, talk a little bit about hosting with me. So your goal for hosting this thing, you know, you'll be able to ramp up. Are you using some sort of cloud platform or...?
No, I actually read an article last night that made me think I'm not going to use a cloud for years.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
A company called the Uplink lost 55% of all customer data.
Ah, they got because into they didn't
fight.
Back up?
They got into a fight with their back-end provider during a conversion from a legacy system
to
a real system. And no, we're not using cloud computing. Our plans for hosting this are to find a local hosting provider. We think we found one. That's good. They have a site, a primary site here in Philadelphia. They have a failover site in Newark, Delaware, which, you know, I've drilled into the business a little bit on the nines, right?
And five nines still has downtime.
Right. Five nines is 5 minutes a year, four minutes a year or something. But to answer your question, we're going to use a hosted bare metal platform where we're going to have SQL Server 2005 hosted on bare metal, not on a virtual. We're going to have a single web server, bare metal, not virtual. And then what the hosting company is actually willing to do with us is they have SSL termination and they have load balancers, and what they're actually willing to do is along the side of our bare metal web server is they're willing to keep dark VPSs, and as volume increases, it's a matter of me logging in, booting the VPS, and bringing that VPS into the web farm. Some of that can be made automatic. Some of those VPSs we might not keep around dark. We might keep them around hot, so that we have more aggregate headroom, if you will, for when spikes occur on the site. So that's kind of the scale approach and the life cycle of how we're going to do this. Now, if we start to bring 3 or 4 VPSs into the web farm constantly, then we decommission them and get another bare metal web server, right? And there's a very nice cost ratcheting effect that you get when you approach it that way. That's scalability. In terms of fault tolerance and redundancy, our plan is to basically log ship our SQL Server databases every 15 minutes down to a secondary site, and we won't be able to afford top-tier internet connectivity with automatic BGP-style rerouting rules if the guy with the backhoe hits the dark fiber. But we will have control of our DNS, and we will have a really short time to live on our DNSs. And I think a complete cutover upon a catastrophic failure is probably about 10 or 15 minutes for us. Once we will practice it.
That's always important, too.
And to get anything more than that with the budget that we're working with, I don't even think anybody, and I'm not trying to belittle anybody, but I don't think that there's even a lot of people who are thinking about this kind of stuff. That are in the incubator right now. They're focused on the doing of the software thing. So are we.
Eliciting the ideas.
But so are we. We're very focused on that. But we also know where we're going when we have to put this stuff into production, and we know how to make it fault tolerant, and we know how to make it scale. And we kind of, that's all in the back of our head as we build. We don't do a lot about it. It's just there. And sometimes we might say, as an example, none of the developers would do this, you know, don't write a file to the file system from the web server. It's not going to be there when the load balancer sends you to the next node in the form.
Right. So how did you guys find Dreamit? How did you get involved?
How did we find Dreamit?
They find you?
no, we certainly found Dreamit. I would say the number one cred would go to a partner with us, Mr. John Valentine. He came on helping us on sort of the corporate development, the business development of this. As we move forward, my partner and I just plain needed help. I was very much focused on designing the product, mm-hmm. and he was very much focused on talking to people and getting the word out. We needed someone to needed some help on the business side, and we were looking for, of course, funding, and we were looking for some business plan competitions to enter. And both of my partners, Peter and Jonathan, are both law students at Villanova, and they have some connections into the Scholastic Network. So we were looking into some Scholastic business competitions and such. And we fell upon Dreamit pretty serendipitously. Just while we were looking for other things, this incubator popped up and said, hey, we're in the Philadelphia area. And we sort of treat it like it was a business plan competition, see if we can get in. And we went through the process, application, then summaries, and then meetings, and just sort of fell upon.
And
but it
you
was
were
the right time, the right place.
Right, and you were working with Jonathan beforehand?
No, actually, we found Jonathan when we were seriously struggling, and mm-hmm. we realized that I come from a programming background, but I put down the keyboard freshman year of college,
mm-hmm.
and we needed to bring in a partner who was an engineer, someone who could feel the product, someone who could really, take it in their and take it by the reins. And we tried with a few other people, and it's really a twofold process finding someone like Jonathan, because you got to find someone with the expertise and the experience and the knowledge base and just the compatibility to work with. There's all that, all those practical reasons. There's also finding someone who's got the bandwidth. Finding someone who has all that, the expertise, but also has the availability in their schedule, in their lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
To be able to fit in something like a startup.
Yeah.
It's
a totally different thing than a normal enterprise developer is going to go through.
Oh, yeah. So I can't tell you how many people we went through interviewing
mm-hmm.
Going through this. I would say we were probably looking for someone to assert themselves like Jonathan since the inception of Tap Inco, and
mm-hmm.
we didn't see one. And once we started really stepping up our game, looking through more people and filtering through lots of people, it wasn't until early June. When did you
second week of June.
When did you grace us?
First and second
first
week of June.
First second week
when
of
we
June.
Really started to make juice go.
It was in Dreamit when we said we got a problem here. Production was struggling. I was feeling the stress hard,
mm-hmm.
and said we need guys. We need someone like Jonathan.
And I've done the startup thing before too.
I can tell. I can tell you've been through it all the way through it.
Orbeus.
Yeah.
Orbeus is the last startup I worked for, which
mm-hmm.
is a social networking platform that CH Lowe, who was the entrepreneur and started VerticalNet, Starsight,
mm-hmm.
eMoney Advisor, all those. That's his new one.
Gotcha.
And I helped them get started as well. And so I learned a lot there. And I'm applying a lot of it here with, again, back to the comments of know what you don't need to not care about, know what you need to care about, know what to focus on.
Situational awareness, so
a
to
lot,
speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I learned a lot there, and I'm applying a lot of it here. And I really like startups in general. I like it because you get to make a hugely concrete contribution. This environment in particular is just filled with brilliant people who are 15 years younger than me, who have aggregate energy levels twice what mine is, and I come down here and get jazzed up.
I think
this is one of the best places in the world to work in terms of an environment. Tap Inco is a great group of guys, but the incubator down here it's a super positive environment for this kind of thing. I think it's a killer environment, even for an old fart like me. I'm 41.
I'm 39, almost 40, so I'm right there with you.
Dodgy corporate America, or if you've even been in what I would call the easy startups, and those
mm-hmm.
are the startups that have a big fat check and investor behind
right.
them.
There are not that many of those anymore.
You're missing that. You're
mm-hmm.
not getting that Tap Inc. is a real startup, right? We're working with very limited resources, and I have no doubt that we're going to get across the finish line. But that's a real startup to me, mm-hmm. is to work with very limited resources and to still produce a best practices product architecture and approach to things, and we're doing that right now.
Special thanks today to Chris Serra of Vuzit for setting up these podcast interviews. Also thanks to Tracy Wilson-Rossman of Chariot for setting up the interview with Chris that led to these interviews. You can find out more about Chariot Solutions, including hiring information, all of our presentations back to 2001, and other information at www.chariotsolutions.com. Registration is now open for Chariot Solutions 2008 Fall Conference, Fall Forecast Computing Among the Clouds. This one-day event, held on Friday, October 17th at the Great Valley Penn State campus, will bring together local businesses and industry leaders in cloud computing. For more information, visit our website, www.cloudconeast.com.